From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm host Evan Dawson.
And I'm producer Megan Mack.
How's it going, Megan Mack?
It's going well. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday indeed. It's a kind of a long weekend, just as a bit of forewarning. We're going to be back on Monday for one of the 2 hours, but we're kind of now sketching out our board. If you could come to the office and see either my office or what we call the BOB, the Big Ideas Board. I won't say what it actually stands for. You'd see there's a lot on there and there's a lot on politics, and we have a lot of things planned coming up. But I hope as we review each week, what we find is we're not overloaded in any one direction. And I thought this was a pretty balanced, fun week. What do you think?
It was. We had a lot of artsy type things. We had my favorite show ever so far, the Don't Think Twice show about improv.
Because Megan is an improv, not only an improv master, but a teacher. So.
And you have come to improv classes.
I have.
And he was fantastic.
It's a sign of my success that I have not been back. But we're going to get to that a little bit later in this podcast. We're going to start with how we opened the week with astrophysicist Adam Frank, who is always my favorite show. He came with a message. He said we were underplaying the bigness of the news about a new planet that has been discovered.
And that new planet is orbiting the closest star to our own. It's just about 4 light years away, and the planet is roughly the size of Earth. There are differences. It's a lot closer to its star, but its star is smaller, meaning the daily temperatures could be similar to Earth.
So Adam came in to say, look, in 1,000 or 5,000 years, human beings could very well be loading up spaceships to move part of our population there. Seriously. And that's especially important if we fail to slow down climate change. Here's astrophysicist Adam Frank.
What I'm optimistic about is that there was a planet there, right? So this is the stuff of science fiction in the sense that, you know, the Alpha Centauri system, which is 3 different stars, has been, you know, the focus of science fiction stories forever. Why? Because it's the closest star to us. And, you know, space is really big. Stars are really far away. So to have a planet orbiting a star that's just approximately 4 light years away is a huge deal, right? And it's even more of a huge deal that it looks like it's a terrestrial, meaning a rocky planet, and that it's in the right place where you could get water on the surface. So, like, you know, that's what I'm excited about, the fact that it's there at all. And, you know, what it's like and what we can do with it, those are topics for other discussion, you know, we'll talk about today. But just the fact that it's there at all is remarkable. And I really do believe that, you know, in the long history of humanity, if we make it, that will be our stepping stone.
Adam has come on this program many times now talking about the impact of climate and why, as an astrobiologist, he is concerned about climate, what we can learn, maybe even studying the stars and thinking at least about what other systems and other potential civilizations have gone through. How is climate related to this one to you?
Much of the interesting and exciting things is our understanding of what the climate could be on a world like this. And I just came back from a conference in Canada, in Squamish, British Columbia, which was called Exoclimes 2016. And the whole conference was about climates on other worlds. And the thing is, we can actually, in some cases, we actually have the beginnings of data. And what's really amazing is how much we can say about climate on other worlds. And the only reason we can say that is because we have studied for the last 50 years the climate on Venus, on Mars, on Jupiter and Saturn, on Titan, which is one of the moons of Saturn that has an atmosphere, and of course, Earth. So the thing is, I just want to say straight off, so we're going to talk about some really cool stuff here, but if you're still one of those people who's hanging on to the idea that, like, we don't know anything about climate, it's all a hoax, then you're not invited to this party, you know, because you can't come to this party unless you accept that, like, we've learned huge things about climate. And I want you to come to this party because it's the coolest party ever.
This is a really cool party. But shouldn't we be grappling with our own climate before planning to terraform a planet in another star system?
Absolutely. But the two are connected, right? Because, you know, the timescales on which we're really going to be able to do anything about Proxima B, especially in terms of going there, you know, we're talking centuries and centuries really ahead of us. But the only way we're going to deal with that is by dealing, you know, we have to get through a bottleneck. Humanity is facing a bottleneck that I, you know, will argue in the book I'm working on right now is probably quite generic for intelligent civilizations. And so, you know, if we don't get through the bottleneck, we're not going to be able to get to the point of being able to, you know, expand out into space, expand into our solar system. And also, the only way we're going to get past our bottleneck is to understand climate deeply, right? Our problem is we've tripped the climate wire on Earth, and the only way to figure out what to do about it is to understand the processes that happen on Earth in more detail.
Now, Adam discussed other potential problems with this new home for Earthlings: tidal locking, solar flares, water, oxygen, and more. It's great stuff, and to hear it all, you got to listen to the full hour via podcast.
Now let's turn to a subject many of us didn't know much about until the Olympic Games last month, racism in American swimming pools. You might recall that American swimmer Simone Manuel became the first African-American woman to win a medal in an individual swimming event in the Olympics, and she won gold. Her success is already inspiring kids across the country.
But did you know, black families were kept out of public swimming pools for decades. In fact, when South Carolina Governor Strom Thurmond lost his bid for the presidency in 1948, he told his cheering supporters, "We might have lost, but we will fight against desegregation." Here are his comments from that day. This is the audio of it, and we warn you, there is some strong and upsetting language here.
But I want to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, that there's not enough troops in the army to force the Southern people to break down segregation and admit the Negro race into our theaters, into our swimming pools, into our homes, and into our churches.
Now, for many years, that was not a fringe view, and even as we've made some progress, there's still a huge disparity in swimming ability. USA Swimming reports that black children drown more than 5 times as often as white children in this country, and one reason why is they simply never learn how to swim. On our panel, we welcomed Marty Keating, a Pittsford swim coach, and at age 73, something of a local legend on the swimming scene. But before you hear him in this clip, you're first going to hear a phone call. A listener who wanted to know, could at least talk about why African Americans, at least from what they've heard, can't swim.
I hope I'm not offending anybody with this question. I am a physician. I was at a meeting of physicians, and an African American physician got up and said the reason African American children don't swim well is because, or in general, African Americans don't swim well, is because they have more denser bodies than non-African Americans. I've also lived in Massachusetts with a lot of people from the Cape Verde Islands who swam like fish, and I just want to know if this is a myth and where it came from and just the discussion of it. And again, I hope I didn't offend anybody. Thank you. I'll hang up and listen.
Dan, thank you for the phone call. Marty Keating is waving his hands at me, waiting to jump in on this. He's just literally waving his hand. But Marty, I think Dan's question is reflective of the fact that the racism and this fear of, you know, when white people have fear of non-whites, imagine, look at all the incredible misinformation that goes on in this country. So you're waving your hand saying, let me have a crack at this. Go ahead.
Very interesting question. I can remember my first NCAA D1s was at West Point in 1972. And Charles Red Sylvia, the legendary coach at Springfield College in Massachusetts, actually came up to me and said to me, why aren't there more blacks swimming? And that had not been my experience coming up in Harlem and having dealt with a lot of black swimming. But when I swam at Central Y in Rochester, I sank all my life. And there was a guy who came out of Springfield College. It was one of our aquatic directors. His name was Jonathan Owens. And I said, I'm a sinker. He said, no, you aren't. I said, well, I am. I've never been able to float in my life. I think my bones are too dense. And he said, oh, Marty, come on. That's a myth. So he taught me how to breathe and to fill my lungs, and I've been a floater ever since. Even though I was lean and, you know, muscular, I have not had a problem. It's more breath control than anything else. But I guess people just have to have an excuse for why there aren't more blacks. Well, it must be their bone density, that they're more dense than white folk.
The good news is that thanks to Simone Manuel and her peers, more schools and community centers are reaching out to people of all backgrounds, trying to bring more kids into the pool early in life. Now let's turn our attention to one of the hottest sounds in regional music.
I can blow out the sun, stop the wind with my hands, give sight to a blind man, the deaf will hear the cripple walk.
That's Danielle Ponder and the Tomorrow People. On Friday the 9th, they're headlining a concert at the Little Theater, which is a great chance to see the power of her vocals live. They've toured Europe, and they're one of those bands that seems to be on the cusp of stardom.
Daniel Ponder is not only an outstanding vocalist, she's a public defender by day, representing low-income defendants. And her own family has shaped her views on the justice system. Her brother spent 20 years in prison due to mandatory sentencing laws. Here's Danielle describing how her music channels her views of justice and equality. Danielle, you know, your experience in life, you have your day job as a public defender informs your work, but also your family situation. Mm-hmm. Tell me about how your music comes together.
So I think I write music in order to heal, from my own personal pain or to heal from things that I see in my community, which becomes also personal pain. So I write these lyrics as to help myself. Like, I'm really not thinking initially about the people as much as I'm just like, oh my God, this is terrible. What's
all right, well,
going
let's
on?
Listen real quick here. It's so good. Tell me about what We Live is about.
So We Live was, when I initially wrote that, I'm looking at everything that was going around the black community, and this was about maybe 10 years ago I wrote the lyrics to the song. So shows you how far we've come. And the thought came to me that, you know, but we are still here. We're still surviving. And as long as our people are still surviving, they still have the ability to overcome. So as long as you have breath, you can't give up. And what I've been able to do in the audience is to speak to that message, but also to tell all of my audience members, if there's something that you've gone through in your life and you survived it, then that means you're strong and you have the ability to overcome whatever comes your way. So that's just a message of hope for me as well. When I'm frustrated, I look around our communities, I'm like, God, everything the black community has been through, we are still here. We are still surviving. So all hope is not lost for us.
Next up, a question. What can we do to reduce the influence of money in politics? This week we talked about pay to play, not only in relation to the Clinton Foundation and her work as Secretary of State, but at all levels of government. And here's how that conversation concluded. It was, we admit, not very uplifting, but maybe it was eye-opening.
You'll hear first from Blair Horner of the New York Public Interest Research Group, then from Sam Fedeli, a longtime citizen activist who has studied money in politics, and finally from Bob Shea, a communications lecturer at RIT. Here's what they say can be done.
Candidates for president, Clinton or Trump, say that they would reappoint Preet Bharara to be the U.S. attorney in Manhattan, because if it wasn't for Bharara, a lot of the stuff that's happening in New York State wouldn't be getting cleaned up, and what we need are U.S. attorneys empowered to go after corruption at every level, be it in the private sector or the public sector. That will make some change, because then elected officials are going to be looking for ways to prove to the public that they're clean. And Bharara is key, and his term runs out at the end of this year.
Sam Fedeli, what do you say to Harvey, who's just feeling like power is going to protect power here? Great ideas, but none of it will go through.
I see only one way to break it. Right now, our population is divided, and we're more polarized today than we've been in my lifetime. But both sides agree that the government is corrupt. You can talk about the state government or you can talk about the federal government. Given that one point of agreement, if we can get people on opposite poles of the political spectrum to begin addressing this one issue, then this constitutional amendment becomes something that's approachable. It is extremely difficult. I think I've mentioned before that we've tried to amend our Constitution 11,372 times. We've succeeded 27 times. So the odds against it are 421 to 1.
So you're telling me there's a chance.
There's a chance if. I don't think politicians would fear anything more than people on both sides of the political spectrum coming together on this one issue.
Well, I have to say I'm pessimistic that it's even addressable, at least in my lifetime. I think this is one of the signs of the involvement of younger people now in certainly with Sanders' campaign was most obvious, but it's true in other campaigns and political action. Perhaps some of like what Sam suggested, some of what Blair has spoken to, the issues of gerrymandering, et cetera, it's a complex system, will begin to be addressed. I'm pessimistic. I think that if we look at history, for example, in the Gilded Age here in the United States, where we had a similar situation that others have pointed out, concentration of wealth and political power, it took, number one, a long time. Number two, it took consistent and, at times, violent confrontations and reactions. We're seeing some of that now. And again, without saying who's right, who's wrong, you look at the structural issues and it becomes difficult for people to see that it's even possible to change without, quote, to use a tired word, revolution. And the question is it nonviolent in the way that Sam's advocating, which I certainly support, and most people sensible would?
Let's close the week by saying yes and. That's one of the fundamental rules of comedy improvisation, and improv culture is the focus of a new film by comedian Mike Birbiglia. It's called Don't Think Twice, and it tells the story of a team of improvisers after one member of the group makes it big. Now, this isn't a film just for improvisers or performers. It's a movie that speaks to many different people because it's all about friendships and how they change. In this clip, you'll hear from Jeffrey Sweet, a playwright and performer who is, frankly, idolized in the improv world. And you'll hear from John Forrest Thompson, a Rochester-based improviser who trained at I.O., formerly Improv Olympic, in Chicago. But first up, here's Liz Allen, an improviser who coached the actors in improv scenes for Don't Think Twice. Here she is talking about how the film is so true to life.
Mike does not sugarcoat the world of improv or even just the competition that goes on in groups of people, whether they're astronauts or improvisers. We all compete in groups, even though we have to work together in groups. And the film struck me the same way. Even when I read it, I was so happy because he's not going to gloss over what's so difficult about competing as an artist. I love it. It hits improv on the head. It's so awkward. And that's beautiful to me. And being an improviser is difficult. It's a challenging life choice. And I love that this movie shows it because it doesn't just make it sound like or look like it's all fun and games. It's very emotionally draining. We're doing personal-based art form, and then we're trying to commercialize it and make a living and raise families. It's a,
can I
it's
add
a
something
lot
in here?
Different of a proposition, because, I think, than it appears from the outside.
Go ahead, Jeffrey.
Well, actually, this is sort of a later development in improv because the early people who were improvising back in the 50s and 60s with the Compass and Second City, most of them thought this was just something they were screwing around with until they went into their real lives. And it really wasn't until Saturday Night Live came along and Second City started being seen as a feeder to Saturday Night Live that the really sort of, I'm not going to say cutthroat because very few of the people are really mean, but the competition really kicked in. Up till that point, and I know a lot of the original people, and I know a lot of the people who, you know, were there in the early days, a lot of the people had no intention of going into show business at all. They were just doing this for a few years till they went on to become professors or academics or doing something else. So
I love that.
This really changed when Saturday Night Live kicked in. And all of a sudden, people started going to Second City and looking at that as an on-ramp onto Saturday Night Live. In a weird way, the tail wagged the dog. Because
John,
all of a sudden, the Second City started changing because people wanted to use it to get onto SNL. And they started coming up with their characters and their catchphrases. And it sort of changed Second City. It's still good. It's still funny. But it's indeed a different world than the one that was created by the people who created improv to begin with.
John Forrest Thompson wants to weigh in on that.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I came from the corporate world prior to going into improv, and one of the things I did at I.O. as a house manager, and they would have Lorne Michaels come for those showcases. And, you know, the difference is in corporate America, you saw a lot of people rooting against people in that competition. But in the improv world, because it's such a collaborative art form and you're lifting each other up, I would say in that world, you're not rooting against anyone. You know, you're definitely trying your best and rooting for yourself, but you very seldom do you find people rooting against someone else rather than, you know, they might be disappointed. It's interesting
to see.
Speak
for yourself, you altruistic alien. Who, you know, did your alien leaders forget to explain how it works on this planet? Did you see the movie last night?
I did, but I mean, even so, I mean, they were still rooting for each other.
Yeah, they were.
You know, and there's a lot of that in that community.
Don't Think Twice is playing at the Little Theater. You can check out showtimes at thelittle.org.
And that is Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can listen to Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS Finger Lakes Public Radio 89.5 FM.
And you can always hear us on the WXXI mobile app. He's Evan, I'm Megan. Happy Labor Day, and we'll talk with you next week.